Happy holidays, dear listener. Ike and I are out in the woods, but we've decided to revisit an episode from this past year all about improving your workshop. So have a very happy holidays and a wonderful new year, and we'll see you on the trail. It's the Underpowered Hour. On this week's show, we talk about new Range Rover's leaking oil, what J.D. Power and Associates have to say about Land Rovers, and we deep dive into the top five projects to improve your workspace. And now, here's the show. Welcome to the Underpowered Hour. I'm Steve Barris, mild-mannered television executive by day and Land Rover collector by night. You can find out more about our cars and what we're working on at thebarriscollection.com or follow us on Instagram at thebarriscollection. I'm joined, as always, by my good friend, Ike Goss.
Thank you to everyone joining us today. I'm the swivels to Steven's open knuckles. I'm the big, shiny balls of podcasting, Ike Goss. I own and operate Pangolin 4x4 in Springfield, Oregon, where we live and breathe Land Rovers. Check us out online on Facebook, Instagram at Pangolin 4x4. Let's get started.
All right, Ike. Well, in the news this week, you know, it's sort of a heartwarming story. A lot of people say the new Land Rovers just aren't like the old Land Rovers, right? That, you know, all this modern computers, you've got, you know, leather. You've got door seals that, you know, work sort of occasionally. But it's nice to know that even with all of that modern convenience, that nearly 7,000 new Land Rover and Jaguars with the P6 3-liter six-cylinder engine are being recalled because they leak oil. And apparently they leak like not just a little oil, like they can leak a pretty good amount of oil.
This is really a legacy feature, I feel like, that, you know, you've got a few legacy features on a Land Rover, little design cues, you get the Alpine windows, you know, you got the hip, you know, in the body, you got certain things that just are unmistakably Land Rover. And you know, where would we be without the classic oil leak?
It's pretty funny. This one is because apparently like a cam carrier somewhere in the oil galley hasn't been completely drilled through. So it's it's like stopped halfway and so plugs up with oil and then just overpressurizes and starts leaking. Or I don't exactly know how the leak happens, but
it describe it in the recall, you know, pretty thoroughly. And so they have to take this piece and replace it with a properly machined piece.
Yeah, man, that doesn't sound like a small fix either. If you have to,
it's not a software update. Although that would be good if it was a software update that you could fix your oil leak. That'd be amazing.
It's just a single overhead cam. Then from then on, they just shut the second one up entirely. Yeah, it's fine. It's exhaust. It's all right.
Yeah, no, it's not surprising to see that a Land Rover is leaking oil. So I don't even know why they're recalling it.
It's just how it works. I mean, it's going to leak oil eventually. It's fine.
Wait a minute. Is this on an EV model?
How is it even possible? Yeah, exactly. They can't get to the all electric version fast enough. Although it's not that Land Rovers are necessarily known for their like high quality electronics either. So it is. It'll be interesting to see how the all electric.
I feel like there's a period of time where Land Rover like electrics are really good, but then when they start to integrate electronics, it's like it's every car of that period. I don't think it's specific to Land Rover.
No, exactly. Yeah, the 90s were not easy on cars and electronics. That blend just didn't. It wasn't smooth.
No, I mean, it's just like, are you an early adopter? Because if you are, you're going to have to put up with these early adopter problems.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, you're going to have touchscreens that just does stop working, or you're going to have something. Yeah, it's going to be...
That's always the first thing that feels really dated in any more modern generation car is the touchscreen. Oh, yeah. Like, if you try to use a touchscreen from, like, the early to mid 2000s, it is so aggravating. It's it's like the dial up of automotive experiences. It's horrible. Oh man, it's just I don't understand why more people didn't just wreck. Like they're trying to get
my feet heated. Chris has the generation of Mini that like first integrated the little iDrive screen, And I am constantly touching it. It is not a touchscreen, but I am constantly, like, why doesn't they say it's not a touchscreen? You got to use this dial down here and just drive around.
Study after study that has basically, you know, hard underlined the idea that knobs and buttons are not only safer, but better functioning than touchscreens.
For sure.
So I think it's only a matter of time for touchscreens kind of, I won't say get phased out because they won't be, but they'll have more, like fewer features will be integrated into the touchscreen. Because like having to scroll through menus and do all that, I feel like it's rough. Horribly unsafe for people to have their eyes off the road and do that.
The F-150 has like essentially like a small screen TV just on its side in the middle of the dash. And there's not one thing that you can do, save maybe the hazard lights and defrost maybe, because I think those are both required to be buttons. Everything else is in the
thing.
And of course, like a Tesla, everything. Like you can't
really
even
bad.
Recline the seats and things without going into the touchscreen and doing stuff. So it's a, it's interesting. Manufacturers do seem to be going that way, which is...
it's harder to feel where the button is if you're not looking at the screen. Yeah. And it's hard to feel that like the feedback of the button moving or the dial turning. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you have a car and you're familiar with it that has traditional controls, it's you don't have to look at it. You can adjust those features without staring at it. But with newer cars, you have to like take your eyes off the road. It's like technology is making us more unsafe in certain ways. Unsafe, and that's one of them.
Yeah. Well, the autopilot will take over and run that person over for you. So no worries.
One of my favorite things is to see the like autonomous stopping like videos where they put like a model child in the street and then like
drag it across,
drive the cars up to them and see if it'll stop. Most of the time it does not.
No, it does not. No. And it's funny. It could be anyone, right? It could be a full size human being, but they always use like a child in a red coat chasing a balloon or something.
They do.
You're like, Jesus, you people are monsters.
Yeah. Based on this feedback, these cars, they want to hit the kids.
Yeah. They have like a bloodlust for them.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I feel like there's going to be a movie like that. Yeah. And you know, with all these autonomous vehicles, you're going to start having country songs where the car leaves the guy.
Yeah, it doesn't need a girlfriend at all. It's just the car.
No,
the car just leaves.
My girlfriend left. My dog ran away. My car drove away.
Autonomous car left me.
My pickup drove away.
Oh, it's going to be great. I can't wait. Speaking of the pickup driving away, your good friends at J.D. Power and Associates have come out with this year's list of quality, reliability, good times having, whatever they do. And how did the Jaguar Land Rover fare this year?
Well, I haven't read the entire article, but I'm assuming that they did really well. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it seems like maybe it's been a rough few years for our good friends at Land Rover. They've maybe not necessarily had the best of times when it comes to, you know, those type of reliability and, you know, roadworthiness, safety, long-term quality, repairability. Not leaking-ness. It hasn't been great. So if I had to wager a guess, I would say they're, you know, sort of maybe a little better than middle of the road.
Well, now that I'm looking at the article, it seems like maybe they have not done especially well in this. I think the way they rank them, and there's a few things to consider here. We can unpack this a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, they rank these vehicles by the number of complaints per 100 vehicles, right? So whether that's a flaw or whether that's a complaint, that's not really addressed. But, you know, the industry average is 186 complaints per 100 vehicles. So more than one complaint per
vehicle. Little more. 1.8 complaints per vehicle.
And the best is 133 complaints per 100 vehicles.
Right.
So you're still getting, you know, a number of complaints per car. And Lexus, I think, took the top spot.
Interesting.
Toyota. Fancy Toyota, right?
Yeah.
So, and Land Rover, you know, they're 273 complaints per 100 vehicles.
So the average Land Rover consumer is complaining almost three times. About their vehicle.
Yeah. Which, you know, it isn't that much when you consider that, but it is, it is twice the number of complaints for
the average. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not twice the, twice the average.
Right, just about.
Yeah. Okay. So it is quite a bit. It is quite a bit, but maybe that says something about Land Rover owners. They're just so discerning that they everything. Their standards are just so high. They want perfection.
They don't want any water inside the vehicle. They don't want any oil dripping.
What do they expect? It rains.
Come on.
It rains. They go through car washes. You can't have everything.
You can't have everything. They want both headlights to function all the time.
Both headlights? What?
Come on.
What?
Come on. They would like two key fobs with their brand new car. You know, come on.
And now they want these cars not to leak oil, apparently. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Most auto manufacturers are going to full electric to compete with the modern emission standards, right? I think California and states like this are really putting the squeeze on auto manufacturers. And so I think that's why a lot of them are going electric. Land Rover, on the other hand, just to try to cut down on the oil leaks a little bit, just to take some of that oil out of the car. That's the only way they can figure out how to do it, is just to eliminate that thing that leaks oil. You know?
Yeah, there's like always these jokes about like Land Rover's leaking oil, and people have their like Land Rover mugs and they're leaking coffee and like, you know, there's like so many jokes about Land Rover's leaking oil. And I mean, I don't find the vehicles themselves, the old ones at least that I deal with, to be that much leakier than other cars of the period.
No,
you know, no. But they certainly have a reputation for that. I've had a lot of old motorcycles that leak really bad just because the way they're designed, but you know, I think people are—they don't like the oil leaking for sure.
I'm worried about all the motorcycles that you have in your office. That if you were to close the door, you would asphyxiate from motorcycle fluid fumes.
Definitely.
Yeah, don't light a match in there.
You see those? Sure. You see those old pictures of like guys on motorcycles, and they have like gloves up to their elbows and like boots up to their knees, and like. Mm-hmm. You know, goggles over their face and like oiled canvas, you know, suits and all. It's because they're just blowing hot oil everywhere. It's like driving a popcorn fryer. It's horrible.
Yeah,
it's horrible. It's the worst vehicular experience ever and dangerous. Oh my, yeah. But I love them.
Great. It is. It's fantastic. My shopmate asked me, he has a brand new, one of the hybrid EV Jeeps. And, his wife wouldn't let him drive their daughter to school because he took the doors off and put the, like, you know, the Jeepy tubey doors, like metal doors.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, like, what do you, like, that seems unreasonable, right? And I said, well, I might not be the best person to ask. I don't see any problem with it at all. I feel like that thing is too enclosed. You know, like, you need to see if you can fold that windshield down or something. But I have seen people with a new Jeep with the windshield folded down. It looks ridiculous. It just doesn't make any sense at all. It's clearly
because you have the windshield folded down and then the cage is like sticking up above that.
It's sticking up above because it's still there. The cage stayed and like the corners like of the A pillars are kind of sticking up off the hood. It looks really weird.
I do appreciate that they still have a folding windshield and they do have still some safety features like a roll cage. So.
They do have a roll cage. That's true. You can do that.
It's possible. It's possible.
Yeah, it is. So for today's, again, as we love inventing new segments, we invent new segments quicker than we can forget the old segments that we haven't gotten back to. But this new segment, top five. So we'll run through the top five things in this particular segment. Projects to improve your workshop, as both you and I are in a constant battle with workshop improvements / time to work on projects. Oftentimes, a good workshop improvement project can make you much more productive. Oftentimes, it can also just suck up the entire day working on some stupid fiddly little thing. But Ike, what are the top five projects for improving your workshop? What's number one?
Number one, I think, at least for me, you know, we recently moved our shop and we are still in the process of outfitting our space to be more productive and more comfortable.
More friendly.
But I feel like that, you know, pretty much the two things that were most important for us is like having a nice floor surface and having lighting. Because if you can't see what you're doing, you know, or if you're working in a pile of dirt, you know. Neither of those two things is ideal.
It's
right?
Not nice. No.
Not nice. So lighting was a big deal for us. And so we replaced all the lighting in the entire building. And it's one of those things that seems easy. You just hang up some lights, right? You just go to the home improvement store, buy some garage lights, and it's fine, right? Well, I think we tried to make it harder for ourselves. And so we did a lot of research, and my lady friend, she is an architect, and so she had a lot to say about lighting, the importance of lighting. She knew all these lighting designers, you know, we got all this input. And you know, honestly, if you look at the specifications on lighting, like if you go online, go to lighting manufacturer, and you look at the specs, it's incredible the number of specifications that a light can have.
Right.
You know, everything from the power usage, understandable, the wattage of the light, you know, that's pretty standard, pretty baseline. But then, you know, you've got graphs and charts that show, you know, the overlap of the light based on the height that you hang it. So different lights work better in different height garages. You know, so that's something that's important to look at, and how far apart that you space them based on that overlap. That's important, so that you get like an even, you know, distribution throughout your workspace, right? Like if you're walking from your workbench to your vehicle, or your workbench to your welding area, or whatever you, however you have your particular garage set up, you want to be able to see things you've dropped on the floor and, you know, have nice bright walls and, you know, light coming off the ceiling and that sort of thing, so that your work, it doesn't make you tired to work in the, you know, visually, it doesn't make your eyes hurt. It's not too bright, you know. Color temperature is another thing that oftentimes people don't consider. Like you, I'm sure everybody has worked in an office or worked in a space and it's got a horrible fluorescent light, or it's got a incandescent light with an awful bulb, or an LED light with just like a terrible temperature. And it gives you a headache. It really does. And if it's a space that you planning to work in and planning to utilize on a regular basis, it really does help, like making that environment cohesive and comfortable to work in is really going to help your productivity. We did that, and you know, we can talk a little bit about that, but without getting too technical, I mean, when you look at your color temperature, somewhere between, you know, 3,000 and 3,500, even 4,000 is not too bad for your color temperature. And then it, like, if it's like a cozy atmosphere, you want it like in the 27,
real warm.
Warmer light. So like 3,000 is kind of the like visual tasks, you know? That's a good temperature for that to be in. And you can go a little warmer than that in your, you can go, I would say 4,000 is, I think 5,000 is too much.
That's what I have, is 5,000.
Have 5,000?
That's my blue of choice.
That's what you like?
It is very daylighty in the, and I have like painstakingly changed everything that emits light in my workshop to 5,000. It is 5, every, because I can't stand things that are slightly, like if something is like 4,200, and something beside it is 5,000, and it looks, you know, it looks warmer, it drives me crazy. So even like, you know, the little, because I have those what used to be halogen downfiring lights underneath my, you know, one of my, where all my electronic stuff is, all my soldering and everything.
Yeah, I would say
change it all.
You know, 3,000 is really the minimum. That's
you can't go lower than 3,000.
You can't go without lower than 3,000. And it is to a certain extent personal preference. But they have done research on this, and you can read these things, you know, they have researched this, like what is the optimal temperature for productivity. And obviously the crisper and bluer and whiter, you know, pretty soon it's like,
it's too much. Once you get above,
you go snow blind in your garage,
you get to like 6,500, it's blue, and you walk into anywhere else, everything else looks orange when you go anywhere else. You can get away with a cooler LED fixture if it's a high quality one that doesn't flicker and stuff, because unlike fluorescent, it doesn't have any green spike in it. So it doesn't like make you want to die. Like the inside of a Walmart. I mean, that's probably a little bit of the lighting, mostly the clientele. But you know, like a department store or a big box store that uses those terrible like banks of fluorescents. Like Costco doesn't. They use high bay sodium lights, or actually they're mercury lights. But But the Walmarts are the worst for having those terrible, you know, like 5,500 Kelvin fluorescents. And they're just like a depressing color to be under. And it's green. It's like got a heavy green in it. So it just doesn't feel nice at all.
Everybody looks sick and pallid.
But that could just be because they're at the Walmart as well. I mean, that doesn't, I don't know that it's entirely the lighting.
Well, any rate, I think the point there is it's worth considering the color temperature of the light that you're using. And it is an important consideration.
Did you do tubes or high bay lights?
High bays. We did high bays. Yeah. And we did high bays with shades.
Oh, nice.
So they're quite bright, but we have these diffusers on them. So. Mm-hmm. It throws some light upwards, mm-hmm. and it makes it not so glary when you look up at the light. So you don't have little spots when you look away.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we have fluorescent replacement LED tubes for the workshop area, but for the car storage area, you know, for the big warehouse where all the cars are, it's still the original fluorescents that were here when we got the building. So one of these days, I'm going to rip those all out and put high bay lights in there.
They're
nicer. And I found this 16-foot model of the Starship Enterprise that is being auctioned off that I really want. It's very cheap.
That's like a foot longer than your current 15-foot model.
Yeah, it's a little bit bigger than my current 15-foot Enterprise. And so I think it would look really cool hanging from the roof of the workshop, but I would have to move the fluorescence out of the way so I could, from the second floor of my office, I could look out on the Starship Enterprise. I think that would be...
It would be like when they're in the repair dock or whatever.
It's just
the
like
first
that.
Part of every, space every movie.
Yeah, every Star Trek movie. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'll build a little space dock out there. That'd be fantastic, you know, maybe. Or maybe I'll just get a big shark or something.
You're such a dork. I love it.
So,
now, wait, I do want to talk just a little bit about task lighting.
Of course, yeah.
Like task lighting, you know, no matter how nice of a light you put in your shop,
yep.
you're always going to have shadows if you're working inside
especially
of a vehicle.
With a hood over top of the car that you're under or something.
Yeah. If you're working in an engine bay, working inside the car, you're going to need a work light. Mm-hmm. And what do you like for a work light, Steven?
Well, I have a couple different ones. I like the Baton lights that have become oh so popular. The one that I use on a regular basis is made by a company called Astro. You can get it on
Amazon. I'm familiar with that company.
Yeah,
they make a lot of garage supplies and stuff.
Yeah, they make some cool stuff. And these particular Astro Baton lights, they're, you know, when I say that, they're like about a 10, 12 inches of LED strip sort of on a little snake arm, so you can bend them right and left. This has a light on both the front of that and the back. So you've got the ability to, and the fun thing is every time you turn it on, you're holding it the wrong way and it shines in your face no matter what you do. It's like
That's
a USB
perfect.
Plug. Like you should half That's the perfect. Time you should get it in right, but you never do sometimes. It's the same with these. And it also has a little flashlight off the end of it. And you can, they're great. They have a magnetic base and you can stick them places and they light things up. But the coolest thing is they also have a magnetic charger. So my charger is just magnetized to the side of one of my Kennedy stacks. And I can just tap those flashlights on the outside and they will charge up. And they're always, as soon as you hang them up, they're charging, but they don't have to plug in or any of that sort of stuff. So I do like those. I'm a fan of those. I don't have...
So does it have like a base or a support so you can like set it on something that's not magnetic, like maybe a Land Rover that's aluminum?
It does. Yeah, it's got a little... It's sort of the battery is in the bottom of it, so it's sort of heavy and it'll sort of sit down and you can sort of articulate it. But yes, it is annoying that you can't put it on the body, but you can put it on hood supports and you can put it on the chassis and stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot of metal brackets and fasteners.
Yeah, I use
everything.
Them pretty heavily underneath the lift, so I'll put them underneath the lift, shine them up into the car, and then drop the lift on top of them and crush them. That's
nice.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't done that with one of the nice ones, but I have done that with some of the cheaper ones. Just smash them into the ground, like it's, obliterate them.
I'll have to be honest. There's definitely something to having that performance and price balance with a work light because these are things that do see a lot of abuse. And one of the ways that my particular lights are abused is they're left magnetized to a vehicle. The vehicle gets returned to its customer. Yes. And so it's they have a new light. But
it comes with every
complimentary light. But then you know, as the weeks progress, you're like, I think we had 20 of those lights and now we've got about 12. So
where did they all go?
Where did they all go? Yeah. Oh, yeah, they left. Yeah, on
we
cars.
Gave them away.
Yeah. So one of the ones that we use is a Bauer magnetic work light that you can purchase at Harbor Freight. And it's about, it's like their premium brand or whatever.
Yeah, I want to
say it's like $25 it's,
yeah,
or something
it's,
like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it's more expensive than you would think something at Harbor Freight would be, but cheaper than anything else you can find.
And it's like a machined aluminum housing. It has a rechargeable battery. It's LED. It's got a flexible light. It basically bends in the middle, you know, and it's got a number of LEDs. It's bright. The battery lasts a good long time.
Yep.
It plugs in. It's not a magnetic charger. That would be nice. And it is a useful light, and people ask about them all the time. But get the warranty because it has a plastic hinge, and you will drop them, and it will break, and you'll
have
to replace it.
It's often one of those things that you can get with the 20% off Harbor Freight coupons.
Oh, that too. You can get them on sale. They're pretty inexpensive. It's a good performance, price, balance product, you know. And we use a lot of them. You know, we have a few other lights. We have like the wands. It's like it looks like an LED
lightsaber
curtain rod, if you will.
Yeah.
You know, we have a few of those that you can stand up or lay down or whatever. We have a couple other plug-in, you know, really super bright, you know, work lights. But those are the ones that we use the most of, those little Bauer ones. They're pretty good.
I have a few of those too. I like those. I like those quite a bit. Yeah, pretty much exclusively the wand style lights now. I have a couple of the floodlighty ones. I don't have one of those big lightsaber curtain rod ones. I should maybe think about getting one of those. But yeah, I like the, especially if you do any amount of video shooting around the projects that you're working on, having those little lights positioned everywhere is.
Definitely
do a bit of that. Speaking of the charging of those things, then we'll circle back to the floors and the cleaning them. But, you know, a really nice thing and something that you're not going to do unless you like say, I'm going to spend some time and I'm going to do this is setting up what we like to call the central power dock, which is a place where you can plug in all your tool batteries, your flashlight batteries, maybe your cameras if you have GoPros and things. You know, I am the worst for having like things in little clusters plugged in all over the friggin' place and it's just stuff hanging from the roof. It's terrible. So finally, I'm in the process of rebuilding all of my DeWalt tool storage stuff. As you know, I bought into that camp and there's no going back now. It's like
that's not true. You can get an adapter that'll put a Milwaukee battery on your DeWalt tool or vice versa.
It feels too far afield for me. But anyways, one central place I have now set up for all of those batteries. They all charge. The charges are right above where the batteries, once they're charged, go. And the same thing with the GoPros. I've got one of those like USB octopus things with like 9 little USB things sticking out of it and just able to plug in all the cameras, plug in all the DeWalt batteries, plug in the flashlights. They all sort of have their own little hubs now where, you know.
You're a big fan of docking? Is that what you're saying?
I love docking. I'm a big fan.
Don't
Google that. Yeah, no, don't. You're not going to get it. Again, it's in like the Starship Enterprise kind of docking. That's, yeah. So, But I think that's a handy thing that is one of those projects where if you want to make your life a little bit easier, setting up one place where all of that sort of shit lives, all your batteries live, and then they're always charged, that's really nice.
Now, a lot of newer toolboxes, the rollaway toolboxes, they come with what they call a power drawer.
True.
And the power drawers have outlets and USB, et cetera, in them. So you not only can you store your tools in there, but you can also charge your batteries.
Charge them up, yeah.
And it's not like a docking area, like you say. It's all
sort of is a docking area.
Enclosed.
It's just an inclusive docking
area. It's enclosed. It's in its own little zone.
Yeah, those are cool. And I'm also, a fan of, obviously, you don't want to drill holes through like your nice Kennedy stack or something, but of just putting a power strip inside of a drawer and having things plugged in so that even if it's a total disaster, you can just close the drawer. At least the disaster goes into that drawer. And like there might be 90 cables and like 14 GoPros and like a, you know, Hydra worth of shit in there, but you can just close the drawer and you don't see it anymore. And, you know, it's all good. But, you know, for me, trying to get into the habit of like put the tool away when you're done using it and like charge its battery. You know, put the flashlight away when you're done using it and charge its battery. That's made ever more easy by having an area where you can actually do that. That's
And when you go to Linus's, you know, he doesn't have any power tools.
There's no battery powered tools.
It's all like bits and braces, you know, like hand drills.
Hand drills,
all that kind of stuff.
You don't have to worry about it. Yeah. Yeah.
No, nothing. You don't recharge anything. You just eat more food.
Just eat more food. It's self-power. Yeah.
Self-power.
You just get tired. You know, we often joke that Linus was the victim of like a Victorian era time traveling accident. And he's just been trying to get home ever since. Doesn't like the modern world, all these, you know, doesn't understand it. It's just not.
Yeah, the first time he came into my house, I turned on the light. He just like cowered for like 20
started screaming. It was weird. Yeah, he's adjusting. He's adjusting to modern life, but on slowly. But back to cleaning stuff. So one thing that, as many people know, I've invested in and I think is the bee's knees, such as it is the automatic floor scrubber, my little floor Zamboni.
I'm pretty jealous about the floor Zamboni.
Oh, it works so good.
Do you have a guy that does it for you?
No, I'm thinking about getting one, though, because, you know, it's like mowing your lawn, right? It's like fun the first few times and then it's work. So, you know, we're at the point now where it's work, but that's okay. I did modify my floor Zamboni, which I didn't get the battery powered one because I'm cheap and I didn't want to get it. It felt that's too much. But I, like many people, have a sort of camping power pack. I have an EcoFloat one that can, you know, run your table saw or whatever you need to do. And it works super good. It can run the floor scrubber, the floor Zamboni, for a full 20 minutes, which is more than enough for me to do the whole floor off of the EcoFloat. And I'm not tethered to the wall. I don't have to drag a cord around anymore. It is it's pretty great. It's a pretty nice system. Now, if you have thousands of square feet of space that you have to clean, an automatic floor scrubber really does make a big difference. Like, it is really a lot of work. It's very time consuming to mop a space as big as our space is. So not everybody needs a floor scrubber for their two-car garage, but they're pretty cool. I am a big fan.
I think having your workspace clean is important, whether you have a small garage or you have a big warehouse. Sweeping is one of those things that is, it's an ongoing task. It's not just a one and done. It's not hanging up lights. It's not, you know, doing that. It's an ongoing process. And the easier you can make it, the better it's going to be. So if you have whatever you've got, you know, a push broom, a regular broom, a dustpan, you know, one of the first things that I made for my first shop, it was also one of my first TIG welding projects when I got my first TIG welder, was building a really nice dustpan. And if you go to like a home improvement store and you look at the dustpans, they basically have two different kinds. You got an aluminum one, which is not too bad.
No,
and then
it's
they have
it's okay.
a variety of plastic ones.
Yeah.
And the plastic ones, even the best quality plastic ones, typically break and crack and are ruined within a very short period of time. The aluminum ones tend to bend.
Yeah.
And then the edge isn't flat with the floor and it's hard to sweep into it. They have a tendency to do that. So I made a steel one and then I sharpened the front, the leading edge of it so that it was really, you know, close to the ground.
Yeah.
And I still use it to this day. I think I made it 15 years ago and it's amazing. You can, you know, that little piece of gum or tar or whatever, you can use it to scrape that off. You can sweep a big heavy pile of dirt or rust flakes into it and it doesn't deform and get all wonky.
Chop carrots with it if need be, you know.
It's great. It's amazing. And so I still find that to be a handy cleaning device, you know. It's really a nice thing. A good dustpan.
Yeah,
it seems
dust
simple,
pan.
But it is really a time saver.
Yeah,
so whether you need a floor Zamboni.
Yeah, you got
or a dustpan.
Or a dustpan.
Yeah. No, I think that stuff is good.
Absolutely.
And a little vacuum.
A little vacuum. The handheld vacuum. Oh, you know what I use and you used as well, I know, is a leaf blower.
A leaf blower is good.
Yeah, leaf blower works real good. You can just kind of blow everything out the door. And that works good if you've got a home, you know, just in your garage or whatever, you can just blow out onto the street, into your neighbor's house, into your neighbor's open garage, whatever. You know, that's that's handy. That's a quick time saver. And I have trees and landscaping around the back of the workshop. So the second you open the door, all of that comes into the shop. And so it's nice to be able to fight back by blowing it back out there. That's nice. So what about, how about little parts and little fasteners and things like that? How do you store that stuff?
This is one of my favorite things, and also one of the things that is just so time consuming and can get very tiresome. And I have a lot of small parts. Yes. I often tell people if I sold every part that I had for a dollar, I could retire very comfortably. Because there are thousands and thousands and thousands of little tiny parts. Yeah, little washers, parts. Little nuts, screws, tiny little electrical pieces, switches, I have hundreds of thousands of those kinds of small components for Land Rover vehicles. And so organizing them is important. And I like the old parts bins. I like them.
Yeah.
And I think we talked about this the other day on the Vice for Vices might have been Vice for Vices or Mexishop. Mm-hmm. That guy had like a really cool Victorian parts bin that was really neat.
Yeah.
Just cast iron,
I think it was Vice for Vices. And then, that's
incredible.
Some cool. Because he's got a lot incredible. Of neat Vice displays as well, like retail displays, which is really cool.
I use a few different things. Mm-hmm. I have Equipto, which is kind of a 50s pressed metal drawer system. I have a number of Equipto units that I use for small parts. Those are good. They come in a variety of sizes and shapes, but roughly they make units that are about 3.5 feet long and about 18 inches tall and 2 feet deep. Mm-hmm. And you can stack them. You can, they have different size drawers for different parts and then dividers within those. Mm-hmm. So those are good for like medium sized parts. I would say that's like a thermostat. Hose clamps, those sorts of things. Amazing for that. You got all those little dividers. We also have two Adressograph cabinets. Yeah. And the Adressograph was a system of plates that these companies used, like mail order companies would use them. And they had an actual physical plate that they used to print every address in their company's database. It was basically a database. So it's kind of like a card catalog, if you will.
Yeah,
but all the drawers are brass, and they have dividers in them to divide these nameplates, and they're incredibly heavily built because all of those plates were little steel plates.
Yeah,
and so basically you had 2.5 by 6 inch wide by 2.5 inch high bricks of steel, each cabinet had 133 of these. So you can tell that they, when they were in use, they weighed thousands of pounds. These cabinets. And so they can support all kinds of hardware. And we use those for tiny little screws, tiny little washers, all that stuff because of the dividers.
Yeah.
And they have labels, so you can label them. So that's good for like small transmission parts, little screws, shims, all that sort of stuff. So we use those. You can find them on Craigslist every once in a while. They made them in different sizes for different size companies. And they're super cool and they're incredibly well built.
Yeah, they are heavy.
You can pick them up with a forklift.
Heavy. Yeah. Yeah. You have to. I don't think a human being could lift it. It's so heavy.
Crazy. They're cool. They're super neat and they will hold all the hardware that you would ever want in a pretty compact space.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not bad.
So in terms of like metal cabinets for medium and small parts, we use that. We also have some rolling shelves that we got out of a Build-A-Bear that was in the mall.
Oh, nice.
And that's good for like, boxes of parts.
All your bear parts.
Probably, maybe a little bit more involved than the home enthusiast would want. But those Equipto bins, those are often available at like on Craigslist or eBay. You can buy those all the time. The Adressograph bins, you can get in different sizes. So anything that's suitable for like a home garage. If you really want something high end, those like Lista cabinets those are super nice. Stanley also made their own line of those kinds of drawers. Mm-hmm. And they're basically for workshop tooling parts, aircraft industry parts supply, that sort of stuff. Those Lista cabinets, generally used ones are $100 a drawer. So if you get a 9-drawer cabinet, $900.
Yeah.
But sometimes you can find them inexpensively on like government surplus or one of these types of websites. You can get those parts storage cabinets. How about you? What do you use?
Well, I have like a version of the Sortimo, which is an Italian brand of essentially think about them as a thin toolbox, right? That have about 20 little individual bins in them that you can take out and you can take with you. And I've got, I don't know, I have 60 of them. I've got way too many. But I, for the stuff I use all the time, underneath my sort of one of my main workbenches, I've built a like index where they can all slide into. And I actually use the Harbor Freight medium portable parts bin as my sort of go-to for that. Everything is built around that size and shape. And I can 3D print little bins that go in it if I want bins that have little dividers or if I want bins that are different shapes. Or and I have everything, you know, in there. I have, you know, probably four of them, maybe five of them dedicated to just metric fasteners. I have, you know, probably the same again in Imperial fasteners. I have two or three just for Sheridized hardware. I have one for all of the different little fiddly electronic bits, little bulbs, light bulbs and fuses and all that sort of stuff. And I have them for, you know, all the different cars and all their different, you know, expendables, fuses and stuff like that. I have pieces for my Rapid Air Click Fit air supply stuff, all kinds of stuff in these boxes. And they come in a sort of a one unit high or a two unit high version. And the little boxes, you know, I suggest buying because they're really cheap. They're I don't know how much they are, but I want to say they're like about $10 for a box. And, you know, you buy them in like, you know, again, you buy 5-10 of them at a time. And everyone comes with a little, a medium, and a large bin. But oftentimes you want one box that's just the large bins, or you want one box that's just the tiny bins, or some kind of mix. And if you get a bunch of them at once, you can kind of mix and match and end up with a sort of, you know, a set of bins that are just perfect for what you want. And then I label the handles of them so that when they're in my index, I can see I've got about five rows of indexes underneath my workbench. And then I've got one whole cabinet full of them as well. And so that's the stuff that I don't use quite as often, little fiddly bits, parts for, you know, proton packs or whatever. They all have their own little boxes. And then all the stuff that I use all the time is in those. And that's super handy, but it is an epic undertaking. You know, how many of those little plastic, you know, variety sets of, you know, cotter pins do you have? And they're in like their own little fishing tackle box, and you got to go like find them in whatever drawer they're in and then sort through and get the right one. And so to take all of that apart and put it all into a dedicated, you know, index and label it all, it's a huge job. But then the next time you go to get a cotter pin, it takes you about 90 seconds to find it. You know, which is huge. It's a huge time saver.
I do like those bins, and I do have, they're usually like a clear top, black and yellow bins. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. The Sortimo ones, all the bins are different colors. So every size has its own color. So you can order it based on like, oh, I need more red ones, which are the biggest ones. Or I have a couple of those Sortimo ones, but they're just too expensive. They're, I think, about $40 just for the case. Mm-hmm. And that would, with a number of those that I have, that would be $500,000.
There's a similar system that is used by a lot of fastener supplies. Mm-hmm. So I think Lawson sells them. A few other companies that deal with fasteners, Worth, I know, sells them. Mm-hmm. And it's like a rack of those style of bins, but they're metal. Mm-hmm. And so not only does it serve like they serve as a drawer.
Right.
But each drawer can then be removed. Taken out. Yeah. And then each one has like a plastic insert. And you can pull all your little things. And we have one of those for like wiring supplies. Mm-hmm. You know, it's got terminals and connectors you know, fittings and all that sort of stuff for doing the electrical rewiring jobs that we do. And that's another one that's pretty handy. And you can find those used inexpensively. I think sometimes in the $40, $50 range, you can find those units. Yeah. They got four or five drawers, and each drawer is then removable, and you can put it back so you can use it in place, or you can take it with you to a project.
I like the being able to take it out and take it with me somewhere. And like, you know, if I'm working on an 80 inch or something, I'll take the whole Sheridized box with me because you need five or six different sizes. Plus you need the washers, plus you need the nuts, plus you need the, you know, and it's just all there, you know, and you don't have to keep walking, especially again, if you've got a really big space, you know, trying to figure out a way to prevent you from having to walk from one side of the workshop to the other every single time you need something. I'm still working on that. I certainly haven't mastered that. I'm working on zoning more and more, but you know, I can't help but, you know, need something that's over in the machine shop, and I'm underneath a car, and I've got to take a 2-minute walk to get over there and get something, and that's kind of annoying. And then you inevitably stop along the way, something else comes up, you know, like whatever, and you never kind of get, you know, it takes forever. So anything that I can do to optimize, you know, the amount of retrievability, that's very helpful. And I'll say last point on that, tool storage is probably, you know, if there's a number one of the five, storing tools in a way that makes sense, that they're easy to find. That's a huge thing. That's something that I struggle with.
So where would you rank that?
Well, I think probably because you use your hand tools more than kind of anything else. Like, I mean, how often do I use my vibratory saw? You know, like I know where it is and, you know, whatever, but like I'll use a 10 millimeter box ended
like
wrench.
You use that tool more than you're willing
sawing.
To admit.
Not for sawing. More the vibratory side. But, you know, you use that 10 millimeter box end wrench all the time. And so having that set nicely in, you know, I have my Kennedy stacks, you know, sitting in front of the lift so that, you know, the things that I need to get to all the time. And then I have my service cart, which is a trick I got from Chris's family is all airplane mechanics. And they build like these custom, you've seen my little under car rack thing. They build like these very custom. And of course, because they're airplane mechanics, it's all aluminum and they're all riveted. Mine is made out of plywood. But, you know, they take like a rolling toolbox and the cart style ones, and they like build these big sort of like hoods on top of them with all their tools hanging there. And like they're in this incredibly like efficient retrieval mode where like the things that they use all the time, because they have to turn these airplanes around so quickly, they've got it all set up in such a way where they can very quickly find and see the thing that they need. And nothing's really in a drawer if it doesn't need to be. And the things that you need are all hanging in front of you. So I try to do a little bit of that. But having a good way to store those things is huge. And for me in the machine shop, having all my milling tools and everything in not just in a drawer, you know, like 1,000 end mills all dumped into a drawer. There's this company that I love. They're a little American company and I think still family owned and run. I'm not exactly sure how you pronounce it, but I think it's Schaller, S-C-H-L-L-E-R. And they make these little red plastic boxes. And they're not really designed for anything except that they are kind of, I think, designed with an eye towards Kennedy stack style tool chests. And you can basically, you measure the drawer and then you can get a little box at almost any increment, a 1x2, a 3x2, a 5x7, a 1x2, a 1x, you know, and in two different heights. So for deep drawers and for shallow drawers, and especially for like machine shop tooling, drill bits, things like that. You can get these sort of like long and skinny ones, and you can have your, you know, your five end mills of one kind in this. And, you know, if you have a lot of indexable tooling and stuff, you can have all the little bits all in little zones next to each other so that like, you know, there's my fly cutter and here's all of the inserts for that fly cutter. And here's the little star end Allen wrench that allows me to change those inserts. And it's all right there. But when I close the drawer, it doesn't all just sort of slide all over the place. It's all really nicely registered and sort of, you know, you don't have to do all the foam and the prep. It's really easy. They just come in a box and you just sort of stick them in the, you know, kind of Tetris them into your drawers. And I really like them. They're super handy and it allows you to open a drawer and quickly see everything, you know, in a way where it's all where it's supposed to be, and you can start remembering where things go. And I love those things. Those things are, they're super handy.
That sounds awesome. Yeah, I'm gonna have to check those out.
Get some. We'll get you some tiny little red boxes. I also love French cleating things. So it's like a carpentry thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I have a lot of anything that's wood in my workshop has like French cleats on the outside of it, so that I can hang. You know, I'm in the process over this weekend of renovating a cabinet that I've had for a long time that I made in my old shop. We put a door on the front of it and we're going to French cleat the front of it so that I can put all of my silly DeWalt tools that, you know, I don't use that like my vibratory saw. I can have ready access to it. Quick retrieval of the vibratory saw. It's very important.
We never know when you get the urge.
I 3D printed some little hangers that have the same, same shape as the battery. So you can just kind of click them on like clicking them onto a battery so that they can hang on there very nicely and everything.
That's awesome.
But that sort of thing, like not having to dig through a cabinet to like find the stupid blade for your vibratory saw for 2 hours while you're trying to do something. It is nice. It is nice. You know,
That'll be time saved. Yeah. There's some upfront investment in these sorts of things that really, you know, will make your time spent in your workshop and your projects go faster over time.
Yeah, exactly. So while top five tool storage, parts and fasteners index, lighting, cleaning stuff, and a way to charge all your stuff, a central power dock. Those are our top five for today, you know, but I think you could probably go on for forever You know, I think you could.
Oh, you're always trying to make your space better, right?
Yeah, there's no end to it. You know, anytime you think we're getting ready to put the plasma table in, and so that has caused the need to prioritize some things. We got rid of one of the extra work tables. Got rid of the grand piano. That had to go.
It's unfortunate.
Unfortunately, the chocolate fondue fountain had to go. which is too bad. I mean, it's mostly full of sawdust and metal shavings. But
the crane game.
Yeah, the digger machine that we had. Unfortunately, had to get rid of that. It is a real shame, unfortunately. But yeah, you got to make room for that plasma table. So now we can make all kinds of dumb little brackets and things that we could have very easily just ordered online in the same amount of time and probably less money. But whatever, that's not what it's about. It's about being able to do it right this second and then having to do it 5 or 6 more times because I did something wrong. So, that's how it is. It's an iterative process. Well, at that, Ike, I think that's it for this week. This is a serious top five. An intense top five. So hopefully that will
we'll
give.
Do it again.
Hopefully it'll give you some tips on improving your own space.
Next time it's going to be a top six.
Ooh, the top sixth six. One is a fridge dedicated to Jell-O molds. But and if you guys do any interesting workshop improvement projects, throw it on the old Facebook group. We'd love to hear about it. We're getting some great Valentine's Day stories. A lot of people really deeply in love with their Land Rovers in a way that doesn't feel healthy all the time. Most of them from Linus, coincidentally. I mean, several different ones, which is interesting. That's out there. So we'll have to come up with another interesting top five. Again, if you have any interesting top fives and you want to share them with us, we'll entertain your top five. Throw it out there. Let's see what happens. We're willing to do anything once,
Worst we could say is no.
Yeah, exactly. So, all right. Well, it's been a slice as always. We'll see you next week.
All right. See you in the shop. Take care.
The Underpowered Hour is produced by Liza Barris, Ike Goss, and me, Steve Barris.
Pavel Svardov composed and performed our theme music. Consider supporting the show on Patreon, and if you already do, thank you. Your support makes the show possible. For even more, check out our Instagram or Facebook.